This is...
Wow!
What a week.
What a week. Politrix.
Good morning and welcome to another edition of Wow, What a Week. Hashtag Politrix with my brother Botsang Modimoame Moilwa. Today, Saturday, the 28th of September, 2024. We are live. Welcome. Please don't forget to tell a friend to tell a friend, because some people don't know we're live, so yeah. They think the episode never happened. YouTube, go to the live tab, press the live tab, and you'll find last week's episode and today's live session.
And you can put on comments there and questions and all the wonderful things.
In fact, whatever's been on your mind about the week that has been, we'd love to hear from you. Before we get into our main topics of discussion, let's quickly discuss the snow disaster last week. Because you work for a transport agency.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people are saying what happened on Van Rynen's Pass in terms of people stuck in snow should not have happened. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, morning, Tato, and morning to the followers and the viewers.
Yes, sir.
And look, first, let me put a disclaimer that I'm not talking on behalf of any Department of Transport or its entity.
Absolutely.
My personal capacity. And I think I've heard the laments and the complaints of the people that the government was not prepared and it didn't handle the disaster very well. They knew from the South African Weather Services Bureau.
Yes.
I think 6-7 days in advance that there will be this kind of snow abnormally at this kind of type, at this time of the year. And the people were saying the government did not prepare. One of the major complaints I heard from people on television and travelers, one of my family members was also traveling on holiday in that area, was that the government should have closed the highway or the affected area long before so that people must use bypasses instead of being stuck on snow.
Yes.
That's one of the laments, if the government knew. But I came out in defense and I was lambasted to say no, but the government has warned the people who had planned to travel to that area well in advance. And first,
what did the warnings look like?
For me, the warning is part of traveling. When you plan a trip, and this is something that I learned when I joined the transport family, years back, I always ask, why are the ministries or departments of transport in the world are always called transport and meteorology?
Sure.
Transport and, weather services. They're also linked. I never understood what's the link.
Mm.
But then I get to know that historically, when ships had to sail, when planes had to fly, when road transport had to move, a traveler had to know the conditions of the weather on the road.
Absolutely.
Or the corridor they are going to use. So, pardon me, it is very important that as a traveler, when you are a driver, part of the studies you do when you do your learner license, not even driver's license, learner license, is to say you must check the tire pressure, you must check the water, check the vehicle, check the road, check where you are going, listen to the news. So people should have known. And not to embark or themselves to volunteer to take a bypass. I don't say, and I don't take the responsibility away from the state. I'm not saying that. I'm saying.
So was there a warning that if you're taking this route, there'll be snow?
There was warning. There was warning from weather services to say there'll be heavy snow and
from weather services to whom though?
To the government and the government, the provincial department of transport in KZN and the national department of transport, they issued statements 1 or 2 days before. To say people who had planned to travel there, they must be careful. If possible, they went to an extent of saying, if possible, do not embark on the trip if you can change or cancel it. One of the transport, it was a school bus from Gauteng with children. I think the principal of that school, the school governing board, the parents of those children were very irresponsible to can put them on the trip when they should have known. And somebody will say, well, they don't watch the news. They don't understand.
Hence, I'm saying that as much as it's on us as travelers to plan our trips and to make sure that we know what might not happen on the trip, to a certain extent, you have to look at, does the average person know what a level 3 warning is? What's a level 6 warning?
And
is there enough education on that? On top of that, given that we have access to cell phones, for instance, I'll give an example. In Hawaii, there was a disaster. But the system in Hawaii is such that your cell phone will be pinged if you are in an area of a disaster, to say to you that this is what is going to happen, go find higher ground or leave this area. We have access to all of the technology, the thing is, we can't wait for the disaster to happen
and then you
to
react.
Say, oh, flip, we're not disaster ready. We must be disaster ready anyway. I mean, you look at KZN. KZN has a flood problem. Yes, it might be sporadic. It might be sporadic. But every time it happens, the first thing we're told, oh, flip, drainage. We have drainage issues. The drains are blocked. There's no water flow. We are never disaster ready.
I concede to that as a public servant, you know. But I just hope that my colleagues in the transport fraternity, they have learned out of this experience, because snow can happen in June, July, and people are still traveling. They don't only travel around September, school holidays. We have school holidays in June and July.
Yeah.
The Van Rennen Pass itself, I mean, I've traversed that road several times. It's a disaster area, actually. Whether it's rainfalls, whether it's cold, even when it's just cold and not snowy, you get what they call flat ice on the road.
Oh yes,
and that's also a challenge, but I think the government can work on that, but the people must also. What I'm emphasizing on is that we must take the responsibility.
Let's all take responsibility.
Let's all take responsibility. Mm. People should act very responsibly. If I have to travel to a place, especially drivers, we all have cell phones.
Mm.
Even people who are not drivers have cell phones. People are on TikTok and YouTube and everything else to check all them gossips and the wrong things about the country.
Sure.
But they never check things that impact on their lives. We have to add to that as well. There must be a national responsibility that we take as human beings before we start blaming the state.
Absolutely.
You understand? So for example, I think the majority of the people who were stuck there, if they would have taken the responsibility to check the weather, to check the warnings, they would have not driven to that road. The complaints to government would have been lesser.
So
for people who said, I didn't check the weather, I don't even know what is level 8. Even myself being in the transport family, I don't know what is level 8 of storm warning, and because I normally don't drive when there's disaster periods or warnings and all that. Naturally, I don't even drive at night.
Yeah.
So those are some of the responsibilities that road users can take. You know, imagine if you fly a jet in that or a helicopter in that weather and you say the government didn't prepare itself enough so that when my chopper crashes, it's still part of transport.
Yeah, but the thing is, don't forget that protocols for air travel
are different from road.
And air travel people are held to a way higher standard.
They behave better than road users.
Because you have to be licensed at a higher standard than us who drive.
Then let's up the standard.
It's bad enough we don't even need a license to raise a human being. We should even be licensing raising human beings. The broken people out there raising human beings.
You know what, Chuck, let's get to our politics. You know what I like about one of the comments of last week?
Yeah.
One of the viewers was saying, hey, Uncle Tat and Uncle B are informing us well. They are also entertaining us there. That was so funny to see that.
In fact, the comments are open, so feel free to let us know what you think. For me, the long and the short is this. Let's not be a reactive people. Let's be proactive. Yes, we generally don't live in a disaster prone area, but let's be ready for whenever a disaster does strike. That we don't look back and we're crying.
That's fair.
We don't look back and we're trying to release funds because now there's a disaster.
And
people need to be relocated or have housing, makeshift housing built for them.
And there's political hyenas there who will put their hands
and
into
then it
those
becomes
funds.
A political
it becomes
football.
A problem.
Become political football. Now I'm taking a picture next to a shack with someone who's lost the entire family, saying, "Oh no, I hear for you."
No,
I
hear you, brother. When I go back to work,
yes, sir,
these are some of the ideas I'll put on the table.
Absolutely. Oreo McT on YouTube says, "Dia boa ko tswane." So the capital without an executive mayor.
Oh yeah, Oreo has read our mind.
Cilia Brink has been, well, he was booted out.
Yeah.
He lost the vote of no confidence.
The vote of no confidence, yeah.
But the DA saying they're going to fight on, in fact, is it Solim Simang?
Yes.
Who are saying that we're going to fight, and we're going to fight to have him re-elected, as soon as a new mayor has to be elected.
Look, Tato, you remember last week we spoke about it, to say come Thursday, you know, 2 days ago, Brink will be out. The writing was on the wall. Remember, they needed Action SA, and Action SA has not been backing off. And if you look at the margins as well, remember the ANC also has a big number there. They are a leading party in the Metswana Metro.
Sure.
So yes, Brink lost. And you know what was funny is, and you know, watching those videos and snippets of shot of what was happening there, it made me recall how one of the negative things that followed Brink, it's immediately when the DA took over, when he took over specifically, actually, there were chaos with you know, employees, no salary increments,
with the unions,
people were not paid, and unions, yes. And I think they started on the wrong foot. You don't mess up with the working class and the unions, and that's why staff members were celebrating. But they must hold on a little bit and not behave like Kaizer Chiefs fans, because we may see Brink coming back after 14 days, and I'll tell you why.
Mm-hmm.
After the vote of no confidence on Thursday, all seemed well. And I actually, you know, wrote in a WhatsApp group and said to the leader of the ANC in Tshwane, Mr. Maepa, Khosi Maepa, to say, hey, bro, this is long overdue. I hope they will give you this. Because the ANC has a policy on coalitions. They've crafted a document that is guiding them to say where they are in majority, they must take the lead of the establishment, whether it's provincial or local or you know, municipal. So logically, that says to me, where they've got more numbers, there must be the mayor. But I like what
and not do what they did to us in Johannesburg.
In Joburg, yes. But what I like about the ANC Secretary General, one of the people that I you know, enjoy listening to in Gauteng, TK
Nisa. Yeah.
Was saying, but we are not hostile with our policy position. We are prepared to go and engage with other political parties, even if we are in majority. If another political party wishes to have the mayorship in exchange of a speaker or more numbers of MMCs, it's okay, we can engage on that. That is how you negotiate it. That's how you get into negotiations. However, yesterday, fresh on Friday, the tone changed. And that's why whoever the commentator says Diabuwa Kotswani, because suddenly the ANC on Thursday evening and Friday morning in Gauteng, and they had to engage with the national leadership. And you remember 2 weeks back I said the DA said should Brink be removed, hell will broke loose nationally.
Sure.
I've said it on the show. It looks like the ANC is changing the tone. From if I read what the spokesperson of the ANC said last night in Tshwane, after engaging with the national and the provincial leadership, it looks like there's a change of tone from what they're saying. They're talking in tongues. They're no longer saying, Brink, it's gone. We're putting our person there. You know, as recent as last night. And concurrently with that, the DA started issuing statements that, no, we're bringing Brink back. Give us the 14 days, we're bringing Brink back. He's going to come and recontest and we'll do everything under the sun to get him into power. Now, these are the two major political parties that have signed a coalition agreement or the government of provincial or national or local unity agreement. And it comes from the top.
And in fact, Msimanga of the DA was saying Lesufi is pushing against national leadership.
Yes.
That we have agreements in place.
Yeah, but who is Msimanga to can tell Lesufi on what is happening in the organization? Lesufi is in a much more better position. So, no, I'm not fighting my national leadership. And the Gauteng ANC has come and said that, to say, we are not fighting, we are not defying with our national, we are engaging with our national leadership. Most important, what Gauteng has done, what ANC is doing in Gauteng, it's what President Ramaphosa himself said jokingly the other day to the people. It's you who voted like this. We are doing the way you have voted. You didn't give us a right, outright winner. So you'll get a little bit of that and a little bit of that. And that is what Lusufi is doing, actually. But the Gauteng is doing it just here to say whoever is in majority must take the leadership of the municipality.
Sure.
And I think that's where the difference is. Gauteng is saying, where ANC leads, ANC must lead. When they lead in numbers, they must lead in occupying a strategic positions like the mayor and the speaker. And I think, look, guys, if you are talking democracy, that is correct. That is right. If the majority of the people in Tshwane gave the African National Congress about 88 seats, if I'm not wrong, then let those 88 seats lead all others.
Sure.
Understand? And this is where we are going to test the Action SA. You know, what do you call it? Principle in politics. Because they are the cause of this whole thing.
Absolutely.
Action SA is an important child of this Tshwane family at the moment.
Let's talk about Action SA. Because some people are saying, looking at how Herman Mashaba moves politically, you can tell that he's politically naive and has zero experience.
Yeah, you can see that fresh. And he's playing into a very dirty hands of people. You know, the ANC and the DA, they are veterans in politics. You understand? But also, he seems unprincipled. And I'll tell you why. You always see politicians.
And to talk about politicians here.
Politicians always changes their mind. But the principle, something you will stick to it, sure, to say, this is a no compromise position. I'm not talking about not working with the ANC. I'm not referring to that. I'm referring to, I am unable or failing to pinpoint what is Action as a strategic position.
Sure.
Towards this behavior. What is it? Is it for service delivery? Do they think the ANC will deliver better than the DA? Are they not part of co-governing in Tshwane in this instance? Because you can't blame the DA to say there's no service delivery when the deputy mayor of Tshwane comes from Action SA. So I don't know where will the compromise be to bring back, and what would have been the challenge and the problem. Because when I apply my mind and I think logically, I think the Action SA were satisfied with that. You know, Tshwane has a deputy mayor.
Yes, sir.
And in my book, she has been doing very well and they've been very happy. I don't think it will make sense for them to want to elevate her to be the mayor against the ANC numbers. It will not make sense. But I don't think that's where the problem is. I don't think the problem is with Action SA. I think the problem is with the arrangement and the agreement between the ANC and the DA, which does what? It leaves the EFF isolated. Because the ANC rose into this position again, or they managed to successfully win this motion of no confidence due to the EFF numbers in Tshwane. The EFF played a pivotal role. But we know that the DA does not want to work with the EFF in any form of government.
Yes.
Again, there's an influence of Ekurhuleni. There's a compromise in Ekurhuleni where the mayor of Ekurhuleni has told the ANC province, actually, in the last 2 weeks to say, I think I must still bring the DA into council and I must award them with, you know, MMC's position in Ekurhuleni, in the spirit of government of national unity, in the spirit of our national directive. So Gauteng has a very serious problem. You know, it's a small, little, tiny province with big numbers, but very influential. They are having a challenge. It will not surprise me. On this one, it will not surprise me if Brink comes back. And you know what it will say, actually? The relationship, the coalition, the marriage, and the agreement between the ANC and the DA is solid.
Sure.
If Brink comes back, it will mean it. So the ANC will sacrifice anybody except the Democratic Alliance. But let's wait for, 14 days? There's 12 days to go now.
Up to 14 days.
They have up to 14 days. I think they will drag it until the last day in order to clear off some of these challenges.
Ntols, in the comment section, says, is it not interesting how the DA did all in its power to try keep Brink in power, but they were nowhere to be found when it was Mayor Mpho Phalatse, Dr. Phalatse in Johannesburg? What are your thoughts of that?
That person is very observant, and it's one of the people who are not in denial that the DA uses its black members when it suits them. Once you
as a means to an end.
Once you have achieved the intended objective, that is cut to. They didn't only do it with Mpho Phalatse. They've done it with almost all of them, their spokespeople. If you look at what they've done with Musi Maimane, who led them very well, you know, under Musi Maimane, the number of black people in the DA went up.
Yeah, but they're saying he lost them numbers at the election.
With their own internal election. No, but, you know, domestically, there was a challenge, obviously. The EFF was born. You know, other parties consolidated themselves. And what are they saying about that? Why are not they saying the same thing with Steyn Huisen? He lost numbers at the elections. You know, but Steyn Huisen is a white person. Moose is a black person. That's the difference. That's why they're also doing that with Brink. But if people are still going to deny in this country that the Democratic Alliance is a white liberal party representing the interests of white people, then they will never know and understand politics. Black people who are there, they are only required when it's time for placards and toy and the voting. That's all.
And free t-shirts.
Yeah. And once it comes to the limelight, they will discard you. You understand? So so I think he's got a well observation. They're still going to fight. They didn't just fight. They're still going to fight. They're saying Brink will come back. And I've said already, it will not surprise me. But it will take the ANC. This is where the political position of the ANC will be read. And by the way, You know, I've listened to Mavuso Msimang the other day of the ANC. A political position does not mean you must think black for the ANC. Mm. Does not mean you must think like a liberation movement. They think for today, they think on the current conditions of the country at a moment. And for them, it's not about liberation movement, not about black and white. It's about who they can go to bed with and who can, they can work better with. Before elections start, you will recall, I'm one of the people who said, it will make policy sense for the ANC to work with the DA because they've got liberal policies. We must not talk historical stuff. Historically, no. But when you look at the way ANC, it's a center, more right party with noise on the left because of the Communist Party and alliance to the labor movement. But when you look at how the ANC has conducted itself from 1994, it's a liberalist party. It's a pro-capitalist. It's a pro-market-based organization, and they are not shy to even say we are a market-orientated political party, and I think it has not, you know, dwell well into our system to say, by the way, the ANC, the Liberation Movement, and the ANC, the political party, are two separate entities.
Sure, absolutely. You are checking out Wow What a Week hashtag Politricks. Myself, Fresh Tato Sikwane. It's weird saying my own name. And Butsang Mudima Memuilwa, we are live on YouTube, so your live comments are most welcome. The Shila Man is lamenting the connection. We are sorting out the connection issue, Shila Man, but thank you for your concern and your comment. Let's talk repatriation of mortal remains of liberation movement heroes that died in exile. And in fact, this story reminds me of a Vernon Nkadimeng. Vernon Nkadimeng was literally my neighbor in Gaborone, Botswana. So there was our house, my neighbor, the block of flats Vernon Nkadimeng stayed at. Vernon Nkadimeng was killed in a car bomb explosion. And we were in class. I remember it was about 10 a.m. We were in class. And so my school was six houses from my house. Vernon Gadiming's flat was three houses from my school. So when this car bomb went off, it literally rattled
the school.
It rattled the school buildings. And I remember half of us ran, literally hid under our school desks. So when we go home, we're told that, no, there was a car bomb and that Vernon is gone. I mean, we were children. I mean, we were like 11, 12 years old. So we never interacted with him, but we knew him. He was a nice guy. He was a young guy.
Okay.
He was a young, cool dude. And all of a sudden we're told, no, he's gone.
He's gone.
In a car bomb. And when you look at the attacks that used to happen, cross-border attacks by the ASANDF, whether it was Botswana, Lesotho, Swaziland, Mozambique,
as far as in some instances to Zambia, they will go there in Angola.
Absolutely. So a lot of those people were probably never buried at home.
Yeah. Well, Fresh, look, my only lament with this, I think it is a good thing. It happened on the Heritage Month in South Africa.
Sure.
And the Heritage Month that I have a problem with and I always question. Nonetheless, I can't always go against the tide. But it took too long, Fresh. You know, especially for liberation fighters that we knew. Let me tell you, on record, that there are thousands of South African liberation fighters who died abroad. Some were killed, according to the reports we are getting, by the liberation movement themselves. Some were assassinated by the... And some, they were never buried formally.
Sure.
One of the people whose mortal remains were brought back to the country this week on Wednesday is the one of the former leaders of the PAC, John Nyati Pukela, who actually was a president of the PAC that time, because he was the central chairperson of the PAC, and after Robert Mangale Sobukwe passed on in 1978. So before Zephania Motsepe was elected the president in 1987, 1988, he was the president. He died in Harare, and he was given a state funeral by the Zimbabwean authorities.
Yeah. So this was 5 years after Mugabe became president.
Exactly, 1985. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Now, why did it take us so long when we knew where the mortal remains were? Because this was a proper burial. And as those that were identified, one of them was the former PAC leader in Lesotho, Potlako Lebalo, and many other ANC that Duma Kanoko, for example, the former Secretary General of the ANC, he was a key figure in the ANC, and SG for that matter. They knew where he was buried, you understand, because it was not one of those that disappeared in exile. So I think it's good that it has happened, and with this, about 47 of them, but there's thousands that are still missing out there. We all know that the 1976 youth leader who was last seen in Conakry, in West Africa, nobody knows where the mortal remains of some of these youth or people are. And I think because these countries that hosted South Africa during their exile years, they had a coordinated effort. Most of them, they were either camps, refugee camps, or they knew what happened. So I think the government must put more efforts, both, you know, in diplomatically consular services, and engage those governments. Yes, there's been change of governments in those countries to can bring the mortal remains of these people back home. The nice thing they've done is that they also didn't just bury them as a gang. They're giving the mortal remains to families to can put closure, which is, you know, in an African tradition and custom. It's very important for families to bury their loved ones.
I was listening to Talk Radio 702, and they were interviewing a family that says they found out on the radio that the mortal remains of their loved one are coming home.
No, that's bad. You see, I was not aware of that. I thought it was a well-coordinated exercise. If that's the case, then it was very bad to say, you know, mortal remains of a family member come. Who did they contact? Who did they talk to? How did they know that person belongs to which family? They should have engaged the family. You know, African families are very big families. They can always be traced and engaged. But thumbs up, let them work better on this. What I was a bit uncomfortable them is being called, what would they call them? The liberation heroes and fighter. Look, for me, the struggle for the liberation continues fresh. Those people died for the land.
Sure.
Those people died for an absolute liberation. And I listened to President Ramaphosa talking and saying they died for the land, they died for the liberation of us to be where we are today. We are not where we are supposed to be as a country. People formed the Native National Congress before 1912, formalized it in 1912. It became the ANC when it adopted the Freedom Charter and all that, in order to fight for the return of the land. The land ownership in the country, it's a problem. It hasn't changed. We are seeing sporadic, you know, incidents of racism. People being killed, shot at, and fed to pigs. People, businesses in Hartepiers Poor Dam, just here, 45 kilometers away, being destroyed based on racism. And we can sit and talk about it. There's a Human Rights Commission, can sit and listen to cases. But for as long as, the same as corrupt politicians, for as long as we don't jail racist people, and you know, people who go, and we must send them to jail and put it in a public space, that the public must see that the government is acting. At a moment when there's racial attacks in South Africa, whether it's farm attacks or whatever, whether it's robberies, we make noise when people are killed, when people are being discriminated against. Then we keep quiet. We don't follow up these cases to see how the perpetrators were punished or were brought back to book. You know, we end up in making noise to say there's racism and it ends there. And we don't even know if these people end up being jailed for this, you know, inhuman conduct. And I think, some, you know, families, I know quite a number of families that have lost their loved ones who went into exile and they never came back. And you can now imagine the anxiety of seeing others received their children or their loved ones and others did not. And I think the government must put a little bit extra effort.
I'm happy it's happening. You know, critics might say it's 30 years later, but I'm glad it's happening.
Yeah.
So that families can get full closure.
Full closure, exactly.
Because it's never too late for full closure.
Exactly.
But I'm also hoping it will be an ongoing exercise. Because like you're saying, hundreds if not thousands of people died outside of the borders of the country and were never repatriated because...
Look, it may also, open some wounds, you understand? I mean, one of the things that I always talk about, and I know it's a very thorny issue, that there were people who were killed in exile camps by the leaders of the liberation movement, by their own comrades, as suspects of being askaris or sellouts or whatever, or sometimes indifferences. We have read in many articles and books that even the leader of Umkhonto we Sizwe, Mr. Hani, before he was the leader, the late Chris Hani, he was one of the people who were supposed to be executed. But he, you know, survived, or something happened that he was not killed. But there were people who were killed. And not only in the Umkhonto we Sizwe camps, whether it was in Apla or Azanla camps, Azanla, which is the Liberation Army of of Azapo at the time, there were casualties amongst, you know, there are people who were also killed by the forces of the host country.
Sure.
Because of, you know, sometimes misconduct. And so we should open up all those things and clean up the wound and you know, let the people now have their rest finally, so that families can put closure to this. Yeah.
Simpiwe in the comment section says, damn, I'll miss the live show again because of another funeral. Askis.
He will catch up.
Nziga says, Batung, Lona le Tsosana Hussein. Nzika saying we're waking up. Nzika saying we're waking up way too early. Shout out to Mrs. Ole in the UK. I am listening and watching from gym, loving the live show. That's Mrs. Ole in the United Kingdom. Let's talk about the judiciary, the NPA, police services, and if they are materially imbalanced, if they are racially imbalanced, and like you often say, if they're captured.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, but Tato, you know, this was brought into my mind by the two or three things that happened in the last week or two.
Yes, sir.
One, as recent as 2 days ago, the court decision on Dr. Hlophe, the former Western Cape judge president. And look, we are having a politician now. This is where the three arms of the state.
Okay, so for those that don't know, what was the court decision?
Okay, the court decision was that Dr. Jan Hlophe has been suspended from being a member of the Parliamentary Committee on the Judicial Service Commission.
It's the same committee that impeached him.
It's the same committee that impeached him.
Okay.
Okay? It's a parliamentary committee. But yes, where I bring politics and government administration in is that the government always, or South Africa, it's a constitutional democracy. We talk of the three arms of the state that are operating independent from each other. Now, parliament, or the National Assembly, as we officially call it, has taken a decision, or it has its own rules and regulations on appointing people. And they have their criteria.
Sure.
According to the National Assembly rules and regulations, Dr. Hlophe has met the criteria of being a member of parliament, of serving in any of those committees. He has met the criteria. Now a political party and an NGO and some, you know, civil movement, which is AfriForum, Democratic Alliance, and one NGO, I just forgot the name, they stand up and they approach who? They don't approach and confront the National Assembly. They take the National Assembly to the second arm of the state, which is the judicial authority. And that's where my problem is. What now, the judicial authority has made a decision to can hold back Judge Hlophe's service on the Judicial Service Commission. It's a service. You're not a judge there. You are a member of a committee. They've held it back.
And probably have more experience than anyone else in the committee.
Probably more than any other legal person in parliament today. You understand? Now we have used the judicial authority, and it's not about Hlophe. It's about the independence of the arms of the state, what I'm trying to explain. Understand? Where is the independence of the National Assembly, which is the legislative authority, vis-a-vis the judicial authority, which are the courts? Where is the independence? And I've said on this platform to you and our followers, I don't think there's an independence there. Because one appoints the other and the other appoints the other. For example, that same committee appoints judges who are presiding over cases in high courts in South Africa. Understand? Those judges get approved finally by the president, which is the third arm of the state, the executive authority. So there is no independence. They are interdependent. And we are going against our own constitution. And for me, this is a judicial overreach.
Do you think there's grounds to appeal?
There is grounds. Look, Umkhonto we Sizwe, they said they are going to. There is grounds to appeal. It's judicial overreach. The judiciary has stepped into the you know, area or space of the legislative authority. These are two different authorities. But despite that, you know what it does to us as citizens? It delays service delivery, because now you look at the timing when this decision is made. compared to the time when the first sitting of this commission is supposed to sit. Mm. One of the things that people are, remember, Umkhonto is the official opposition in South Africa now. Mm. Eh? Do you know that the constitution or the rules of the National Assembly says members of that committee must, three of them must come from the opposition.
Mm.
You understand? It does not mean in any format or what. Three of them, there are six members, and it can be more, but three of them must come from the opposition. So the opposition in this instance, some controversy is the first opposition, followed by the EFF, and then maybe any other political party, which is not part, like the ACDP, which is not part of the GNU. Now that's where the overreach comes in.
Okay.
We are interfering with affairs of the other. But also I looked at the cases of Lama. Is it Loma or Lama? The guy who was repatriated, extradited, actually, is the right word, from England regarding the...
Oh, yes. The Kusile Power Station.
The Kusile Power Station, the Eskom, yes, corruption matter.
Looting.
Looting, yeah, yes. Well, that's not even looting. It's beyond looting because it's billions. You look at the treatment that the National Prosecuting Authority gave this gentleman vis-a-vis what they offered to the PA of, what do you call it, the PA of former Premier of Gauteng, it's Makashule, who was last month, not long, extradited from the US.
Yes.
She was handcuffed, was not allowed to talk to anybody, thrown into the police vehicle, spent more than a week in detention to apply for bail. Eventually, she got bail. This one, we must also remember that he was a fugitive.
Mm.
He ran away. He was a fugitive.
Mm.
But the man was still, he was never handcuffed. I don't care about his medical conditions. It does not mean you can't be handcuffed, because he came in being pushed with a wheelchair.
Yeah.
Humanitarian, thanks, South Africa, a good country.
With a neck brace on.
Yes, but the minute, if people paid attention, the minute he reached the police vehicle, he got off the wheelchair, he took himself into the car. He was not assisted to get into the car.
Mm.
He was not handcuffed. I'm simply saying, when you look at these things, these are the things that says to the people in South Africa, there is racial, you know, differences in how the system is treating people. Sure. We are seeing it live. I'm not making anything. Right now, there's a lady who was sentenced to prison for 5 years this week for being a corrupt or benefactor of some, what do you call that incident? Of corruption. It's not the VBS, the other scandal. She was sentenced to 5 years.
Mm.
She was a very junior person, like an officer or a clerk in that whole process, and she got kickbacks.
Oh, yes.
You understand? She got kickbacks.
Or the Digital Vibes scandal.
Digital Vibes scandal.
Yes, in the Department of Health.
Health, yes. And I think it's the case that involves the former Secretary General of the ANC and the Minister of Health.
Yes.
That case. Now, I always say the government will go for low-hanging fruits and small fishes when it comes to crime. This is a very small fish. She got less than half a million, about 380,000 rands as a kickback sentence to effective, and again, this is why I question the judiciary, effective 5 years in jail.
Mm.
The big fishes of Steinhoff, who came and said, I stole billions, I'll cooperate with the state, I confess. Then you sentence to 5 years, totally suspended in jail.
Mm.
380,000, first time offender. 380,000, you go 5 years effective in jail as a mother. Then you've got a white person who stole billions from the state.
And cost other people
lives.
Billions.
Yes, lives. Some people lost lives because of all these things.
Yes.
Now, where is the judiciary applying their minds?
Mm.
This is where I'm questioning the conduct of the police, the NPA, and our judicial system.
Mm.
The recent one of Loma, the recent news, as recent as this morning, actually, as I was driving to the studio, his lawyer was on the radio saying, he has heard, but he hasn't confirmed with the client that he may turn a state witness. Again, that part, I've got a problem with that part of the law. That high-collar crimes, people who steal billions of rands from citizens or from the government, once they are caught, they become state witnesses in order to can walk away with lighter sentences or no sentences at all. I think, you know what does that do? It actually encourages people to be criminals. When I look at it, if I can go and steal a billion rands and the state recover half a billion and another half a billion, I've squashed it somewhere, and I say I will pimp Trevor and Fresh and Mr. X that they are the ones who were stealing with me. Then our legal system is a problem, because then it makes those who can betray their fellow criminals,
yes,
you can get away with murder or with crime. And it encourages, I'm saying, it encourages people to be criminals if they can barter with the state, you understand? To say, no, don't send me to jail. I'll tell you how I stole the money and with who,
yes,
and where's the money. So it's okay. If you are caught, you can negotiate your way out. If you are not caught, what if they don't get caught? Look at the billions, if not trillions, of rents that the country lost due to the Kusile power station failures and the looting and the robbery. We have lost, you know, businesses are closed. People have lost lives because of load shedding. There were hospitals where machines went off, kids incubators were not working. So the looting of Eskom created murder as well.
Yes.
In a normal country, some of these people will be charged for murder, understand, as well, because their action resulted people losing their lives. And we are not doing anything.
And the actions were premeditated.
They were premeditated. Yeah. That's another thing. They were premeditated. That's why I call it murder. Understand? And we let them negotiate with the state. What are they negotiating? What is the NPA? How do you negotiate with the thug, first of all? Right now, the police commissioner of KZN is not negotiating with thugs. If they shoot at the police, they kill them. We are clapping hands. But our law, another entities of law, the National Prosecuting Authority, the courts, and everybody else is negotiating with criminals that are costing this country trillions of rents that could be aiding with unemployment and other issues we are faced with.
In fact, speaking of murder, there's another case that made headlines this week. A soldier who intentionally infected his girlfriend with HIV, who's been sentenced to life in prison.
Yes.
Because apparently he intentionally, knowing he was HIV positive, removed the condom without her consent.
Yeah.
Which also then made it a rape issue, because he stealthed, as it's called. Stealthing is removing the condom without telling your partner that you've removed the condom.
Yeah.
And the courts have seen that as rape. So my question is this. I agree that anyone who intentionally infects another person with anything is a shitty person and should go to jail.
Yes.
But the minute we talk about attempted murder,
yep,
what are we saying of the fact that an HIV positive status, in the bigger scheme of things, is not a death sentence?
It's not a death sentence.
You can live another 50 years on one pill a day. And are we not reversing the gains we've made against stigma? Because the stigma generally is, I'm HIV positive, I'm dying tomorrow.
I'm dying tomorrow. Yeah.
You know what I mean? So as much as I agree that someone must be thrown in jail for a very, very long time, I don't know if it's attempted murder.
It's again, you are bringing up the overreaching aspect.
Yeah.
The judiciary is overreaching, and they're even doing a mistake against another government entity. The health sector has been saying, guys, HIV is not, you know, a death sentence. And I agree with you. I think it's far-fetched. Understand, you can say, did that person die because of HIV? No, the person is still alive. He was infected with HIV by this person. You know, first, it's a very thin line to can come to those areas. In that case, the sentence happened this week. But it's a very old case, you know, it's a few years old. And again, does the court say, so when you are HIV positive, you should be knowing that you are going to die, you are going to kill someone? Then the court is wrong. Then the court is absolutely wrong, because that guy can call medical experts to come and testify and say, but that is not true. And you know, also, you look at, do we want to go and charge the Minister of Health and the President of this country for infecting people with what now has become evidence, and South African scientists are involved in that process with some Italian scientists, that COVID vaccines are causing cancer and they had an excess of certain toxins. Are we going to charge them for attempted murder? You know, because in some instances, people like in the health sector, if you remember, people in the health sector, they were not forced to, but they were required you know, those words I'm using them very carefully, to can go and vaccinate for COVID and all. Are we saying that? We are dealing with quite a number of things. We have spoken in the past about road traffic infringement. You drink, you get into your limousine or your Ferrari, you get into the road, you crash and you kill people. Are we now at a stage where we are charging those people for murder and send them for murder?
In fact, given that Jub Jub was charged with murder, it was murder. Then any drunk driver that kills a person must actually get, because that the precedent was set.
Yeah, exactly.
That you knowingly went into a vehicle, knowing you're drunk, knowing you're high, and people are dead.
And in that case, if people are not careful, it has set a precedent fresh of saying, even if a person does not die,
yes,
you will be charged with attempted murder. Yep. And this week there was a ruling, actually, of, you remember that reckless truck driver who when there was an accident in KZN?
Yes.
He was also sentenced to an effective 10 years imprisonment this week for murder and all those. So it's our judiciary. Well, you know, you must think of them as human beings as well, these judges. You know, there's a lot on their shoulders, but we need to review and revisit our laws. We still have laws that were created during the apartheid era. You understand? And we're applying them, as if things are still the same way. I have a challenge with that, that I will be sitting in court and some judge or law prosecutor will be reading me the Criminal Procedure Act of 1967. For God's sake, I fought, I was in the battlefield against that law, and it's still applicable today. What are our lawmakers doing? What are our people in parliament doing? We have had 30 years to... You can't rewrite laws in 30 years. I fully agree with that. But we should have at least repealed at least half of the laws that were apartheid era laws, including the Land Act of the apartheid era. You know, repeal it and reverse it completely. But I think our judiciary and our NPA have to up their sleeves. I think there is a lot of racism that is happening in our courts. You know, when we go to courts, I go to courts a lot, not because I'm a naughty citizen, but I always find myself on the wrong side of the law. And you ask yourself if it's a black judge or a white judge, if it's a woman or if it's a man. We still think those, because they influence. You know, I was telling people the other day, they never go to a divorce court and the judge is a woman. Chances of you a man working out nice are very slim.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, I'm telling you, are very slim.
So are you saying she's going to apply her emotions
it
and not the law?
In naturally. We are human beings. Judges are human beings. And I have seen it, you understand? Mm. And the same with the racism one at the moment. You can see about the way Judge Klopper's matters are being handled. Again, let's use logic. The Democratic Alliance, going back to the point under discussion, had said you cannot take the person to go and be part of the committee that impeached him. That's why, that's part of their argument, man. If I was a lawyer, I would have gone to the Western Cape. And you know what they have said? You cannot bring a man who was the judge president of this court that dismissed him to come and judge me on another matter. Is that fair?
Exactly.
You understand? Is it fair that Judge Klopper was in the High Court of the Western Cape where they fired him and he was impeached? Why don't you take him to another court where we say he has no history with that court?
There's no conflict.
Conflict. But judicial minds will say, no, but the law does not work that way. The law says a matter must be heard within a jurisdiction. So Parliament is in the Western Cape, so the Western Cape High Court must hear that. But that's not what I'm questioning. Or even if I question the law, where the law does not make sense, where there is conflict of interest. And again, this goes back to what? All these cases we have mentioned, we are setting precedents as a country. When they happen, they will one day happen to the son of the president. They will one day happen to a minister. They will one day happen to some of them. It will catch up with them when there's judicial overreach. We saw judicial overreach with Justice Zondo and Mrs. Jacob Zuma. These people fought at their homes for being sbarre, phobi. They take the matter to the commission. Then they take the matter to court. We as a nation had to deal with who has a child, with who's not paying maintenance. I mean, those things came up in court. I'm not making them.
Yeah.
They came up in court. That one of them is not paying papret or maintenance for the child, alimony, and therefore you can see now family battles are being taken to our courts, and where is the law drawing the line, and for the judges and lawmakers to focus on what they're doing. But this one of Judge Klopper and the DA and the National Assembly, we must watch carefully how it's going to unfold. That that is the court going to tell the National Assembly what to do?
Sure.
As if there are no rules governing. If there is no rule, if it's silent, let them deal with the gray area, the silence area. Don't use one case to create the law.
Yes, sir.
You understand? Make the law. Where there's no law, go and say, well, there's a gray area here. Law writers in 1993 to 1996, they missed this part. You understand? I mean, I don't want to blame lawmakers of 1993 to 1990 who wrote this constitution. They actually were, what do you call, short-sighted. They never thought a judge would be impeached and come back to serve.
Yeah, but also generally, it's not even about short-sighted. It's never in anyone's wildest judicial dreams would you think something like that would happen.
It happens. That's why there's impeachment. It does happen.
You see, now we know. Now we have the benefit of experience and now know better.
Yeah, now go and make the law that addresses that.
And then also look at other scenarios.
And practices.
What yes. else could possibly happen
exactly.
so that we're prepared?
Exactly. Exactly.
Not call to that judicial pants down.
Exactly. Exactly, yes, my brother. Thanks.
Let's go to the UN General Assembly. It's been an interesting week. You know, whether we talk about Lula, Netanyahu, Ramaphosa. It's been an interesting week at the United Nations.
Look, I let me start with our president.
Yes, sir.
I think, you know, I don't know. I don't know whether it's a gift or what. President Ramaphosa would have made a good foreign minister.
Mm.
He has the ability of switching. Whenever he's talking to the Chinese and the Russians and Iran, he's a different person. Then when he's talking to the West, he's also a different person. It may be a good diplomatic way to can negotiate, but it's also very dangerous because then you've got double standards.
Mm.
It's like you don't have a principled position of what you are doing.
Double dealing.
Yeah. He goes and engages the United Nations, and he was toned down. It was not that President Ramaphosa who went to the ICJ with Ronald Lamole as the Minister of Justice before Naledi Pandor.
Mm.
He toned down because he's addressing the West. He's addressing, you know, the UN is the West, basically, even if it has countries of the East, but the West is dominating the UN. You understand? Mm. So for me, to the reason I will bring the Lula part in, President Lula da Silva of Brazil, he actually, if you listen to his speech, I actually even printed it. He spoke like he's an African.
Mm.
President Lula spoke about how Africa is the rich continent, but its wealth is being stolen by the Western countries and not shared with Africans. And he was wearing a green, gold, and black tie. You know, I'm very observant of such. I'm like, did President Ramaphosa give President Lula the speech and the tie?
You know?
He was wearing an ANC color tie, and he was talking as an African. He was talking about the minerals from Sahel to sub-Saharan Africa and everywhere. And this is the man from Latin America addressing the UN, something that I personally think President Ramaphosa should have brought that thing to the fore. He did raise a number of important issues, the issue of Palestine, the war in Ukraine. He has raised them, thumbs up. But I think he was too toned down, especially looking at where the world is at the moment with all these wars. And my challenge also is him going to tell the West that they are looting Africa. They are taking minerals from our land, and this must stop. Part of those minerals fresh. Look at it this way. President Ramaphosa has the ink and the pen to can change the laws that the West must stop looting our mines. Somebody comes, and I made an example to friends during the week, and I said to them, somebody comes to your house, takes your kids, your car, your wife, and put you in a corner there and says, I will call you in to come and eat with us or sleep with us in the main house when I want. And you go to that person. The day you have shuttles out, you go to that person and say, can we talk, man? Can we talk? You can't be asking my son to do gardening. He's good in washing dishes. That's what President Ramaphosa is doing. He's going to the West to say to them, you can't be looting our minerals, our gold, our uranium, our platinum. He's got a pen and paper to make laws in this country that will make those foreign agents to stop looting. Simple as that. Why go to them?
I'll raise you a President Lula could have also addressed African leaders.
Yes.
To say, stop allowing yourselves to let your people down by allowing this looting to happen.
Yeah.
It's all good saying to the West, stop looting Africa. But if our leaders are saying, you're welcome, It's also your home.
Yeah.
That doesn't help either.
I agree with you, but that's what I'm saying. President Ramaphosa was not supposed to go to the UN and raise this issue.
Yeah.
He was supposed to go to the parliament, the National Assembly in Cape Town, to the lawmakers or to his cabinet and say, can we draft and change laws? We've got a mining charter.
Yes.
He must actually do what Masisi is doing in Botswana with a mining charter that Zuma left hanging at 27% of the mining minerals to be redistributed in the country. President Ramaphosa is supposed to take this moment. It is his second term, and he's sitting in the government of national unity now, as they call it. He's supposed to go to his cabinet and to parliament and say, guys, no, this mining charter must be brought into effect. For us to stop the looting of our mining minerals, we are going to pass laws. Remember, we are a law-abiding country. We want to stick to what the law prescribes. So for Anglo Ashanti, for Anglo Gold, for Anglo America, and all these mining companies that come from foreign countries to stop taking our platinum, diamond, gold, uranium, you call whatever it is, for them to stop, we must pass the laws. And who has the power to pass the laws? Those bloody 400 MPs sitting there that we have deployed with our votes are the ones with the power led by President Ramaphosa. They are the ones with the power to change the laws that can make these companies. And why are we afraid? You are not afraid to go and beg in front of over 100 nations. You want to go and beg and say, stop looting our resources and take our unfinished product and selling them back to us. You go and you beg, but you are afraid where? The West is not there. It's you with your comrades and your fellow lawmakers. You are afraid to stand up and say, guys, let's change this law.
Hence, I say, at some stage, it needs to stop. We need to stop with the blame shifting and look in the mirror and say,
it's us.
What role am I playing
exactly
in the problem that I am in the first place?
Yeah, I agree with you. And after they do that, these African leaders, you know, I saw a very nasty comment on Twitter saying, somebody was saying, can somebody send one missile to the United Nations headquarters? Because everybody's there at a moment. I'm like, that's very nasty, okay?
It's called a hard reboot.
Yeah, reboot the world. Again, these African leaders, you know, on a lighter note, but for me, it's not a lighter note. I know people say it's a lighter note. There's somebody who went and did an analysis of the arrival of dignitaries at the United Nations. And before they boot out Netanyahu, they say all African leaders, all fresh, not most, all, including our own president, when they arrived with an entourage, the delegation, was all of them more than 10 people. This is the poorest people, or people representing the poor continent. They all were staying in 5-star hotels. All African leaders in New York to the United Nations General Assembly were staying in 5-star hotels.
For security reasons, shouldn't you be staying in a decent establishment?
What security? So are they saying the Prime Minister or the President of France, Macron, is not at risk? Compare Macron and Ramaphosa. Who's more at risk in the world at the moment?
Was he at a 2-star?
Ooh. Some they stayed in low-cost housing hotels. Some they even shared vehicles there. I've learned that the Chancellor of Germany came with a Mercedes-Benz and he gave a lift to the Prime Minister of Luxembourg. They drove in the same car. African leaders, they all had Mercedes-Benzes, limousines, big cars with a convoy of security, personnel, staff members, as if they are the world leaders. They are not even leaders in their own countries because Africans don't want them. Africans are rebelling against, they are not rebelling enough. But the people are not happy in this continent about their leaders. Then they stay in 5-star hotels. Then they drive big cars. Then they've got the biggest delegation. What to do at the UN? Two things, despite three, the show of one. But two things that they went there for. They went there for to ask the so-called superpowers to give them two seats to allow them seats in the United Nations Security Council. That's the first thing. The second thing they go there for is to go and ask for foreign aid. France, America, please, UK, help us with money, help us with some more billions. Our people are starving. But you rock in a Mercedes-Benz, you rock in a limousine with 10 bodyguards. Again, that's how stupid our leaders are. And I'm using that word very strongly. They're very stupid because no normal person. I can't be a broke father and go to my neighbors to ask for money to can buy my children food and I rock in with a Louis Vuitton suit, driving in a limousine or a Porsche or a Ferrari. What nonsense is that? And that's what our leaders are doing. They are actually a shame to the face of the world. You know, I saw one of the videos when one of the African, I think the leader from Ghana arrived. A chancellor of Germany was standing there to receive him, you understand? And he was just astonished, you know, at the number of cars that were parking there. Not one, not two, seven, eight vehicles. And I think African leaders are a disgrace. They are actually a disgrace. They are misrepresenting us. They are wasting our resources. That's why the West will take trillions of uranium and gold and diamonds from our land, and they will donate 1 billion. And that 1 billion, half of it goes to the president and the cronies.
Yeah.
That's what is happening in this continent. Before it goes and build one hospital, and that hospital will cost half a billion. A hospital that costs 100 million will cost half a billion in Africa. And the West, who are donating this money, and I've worked in an NGO, you know, from Denmark that was donating money for Africa. And I've seen how monies are being squandered. Actually, I was employed to stop that. I was appointed to stop our own people from squandering the money. And it's upset. It's hurting that we have African leaders who go to New York and they think they went shopping.
Yeah,
you understand? That's what they do. They go shopping and waste state resources, and the West allows them. But the West will allow them. You know why? We are stimulating their economies. We are big spenders. They give us money. The president steals it to buy their wife a Louis Vuitton bag when kids in the hospital, they don't have basic.
You also forgot not just the wife and the small house. It's also maintained the small house.
Probably. Yeah, and probably the smaller house as well. But again, it's a disgrace what our leaders are doing. And none of them, not even one of them, is calling them to order. Not one African president stands up and say to others, our brothers and sisters, let's stop this.
Let's do better. Let's be
Let's do better, man. Let's be better people. Not one of them. And people are saying, I'm talking with disrespect when I talk about them. They don't respect themselves.
Yeah.
How do they expect us as citizens of the continent to respect them when they don't respect themselves? You can't tell me out of 54, man, okay, it's not 54 because we've got some countries like Burkina Faso not being there. Let's say approximately 47 countries go to the UN representing Africa. Not one of them has the brains, functional brains, to say to the others, sons and daughters of the soil, as we call each other, let's go and meet somewhere in a bar or two-star hotel. And we're in New York, for God's sake. The two-star hotel in New York is better than some of the official residences in Africa or some of the hotel five-star hotels in Africa. You understand? So why wouldn't they do that? What is this exorbitant manner? That's why you find in Africa, you know, slave queens and youngsters thinking that being opulent with material and resources, it's a good thing. It's a sign of it. They see it from the leaders. They see it from the people who have put into power to lead us. It has looked normal for a township boy whose parents are struggling to want to wear sneakers that are costing 5,000 rands. Because the president is competing with this boy. He's wearing sneakers that are worth 5,000 rands. And that's the kind of leaders we are having. And I think we should start talking about these things. President Ramaphosa must actually drive himself, man. You know, at some stage, he must just say, security, let me drive myself. The man will even lose driving skills. The day we fire him, like we fired Brink, what is he going to do?
At least he's always walking, so he's got experience.
Oh, yeah, he's walking. He's one of the, you know, when you are, it looks like everybody in Cape Town is walking because they've got space and nice places to walk.
Absolutely.
But yeah, that's what happened in the UN, and that's very disturbing.
Let's talk about Netanyahu.
Oh, yes, the Prime Minister of Israel. In standing up and addressing the UN, there was a walkout. He was being booed, and thumbs up and but look, it's a symbolic gesture to say we don't want to listen to you. And they didn't walk out when he was called in, when it was his term, just when he started talking. But he continued with the arrogance. He continued to
let me tell you something. Every nation could walk out of the General Assembly, and America remain. That's all he wants.
Yeah.
They're like Bonnie and Clyde. That's all he needs in his life.
And they've got a lot of seats there, and it's in their land, so they'll have more Americans sitting there. Even there's administrative people sitting there.
I don't think he cares.
He doesn't care.
And I think generally the global writing has been on the wall. in terms of what people feel about the occupation of Palestinian land since the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think he cares. Netanyahu has never cared, and I don't think he's about to start now.
But look, that walk out, look, the world is changing. The world is moving slowly into a different direction.
Mm.
And I think it will dawn into the head of the Americans and Israelis that their time will come when this whole thing will end. I'm starting to think that actually Israel is suicidal. I think they're suicidal. You can't go and be bombing 5-6 countries at the same time, and you are saying to them, bring it on. Mm-hmm. You understand? You can't be doing that. I think they are calling for a third world war. I think they are calling for a full-scale war. And they must be very careful, because once this war, in my view and opinion, once this war starts, it will not be an Arab-Israeli war. Mm. It includes many other countries who have vested interests in that area. And I think the American elections must come as quick as possible to save the world. I still believe the decision in America is going to change the game, especially if Donald Trump, for peace sake in the world, he's a typical American as well. But for peace sake, for the rubbish that is happening in the Middle East, in Gaza, in Palestine, in Beirut now, Lebanon, I think the arrival of Trump may hold this back a little bit.
But looking at the polls in the U.S. over the past week, Kamala Harris is polling way better than Trump right now.
Yeah, but it's too early. There's still a month to go. It's still look, the media will portray that. Remember, this is about money there. And who has the media? Who has the voice in the media? Some people talk better than others. They express themselves better than others. Kamala Harris has been more in the media and public platforms and been liked more, talk things that makes more sense to people. And it defeats Trump, because Trump is a doer. He's not a talker. He's not a good talker.
Mm.
You understand? He's not the best person you can put on a platform. He will start insulting and calling names, telling us how Kamala is not actually black and things like that. And I've seen that somebody in the U.S. has released Kamala Harris' birth certificate that actually says she's not really, really a black person. But that's neither here nor there.
Mm.
I think the elections in the United States are going to be very important for peace in the world, both in the NATO war with Russia, as well as with what is happening in the Middle East.
Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine says he has a victory plan.
Yeah.
But the victory plan that he feels will bring Russia to their knees and maybe want to negotiate obviously involves them being able to lob missiles into Russia.
Yes.
And Russia are saying, if there are any American missiles or anybody else's missiles in our country, you are declaring war on us.
Yeah, well, Tato, if where will Zelensky get the missiles from if he's not from the UK, the US, and France? You understand? And I think, look, there is no war that is a good war. But I think Russia is correct in this instance. If the USA is going to give Zelensky missiles to can attack Russia in the mainland, then clearly the USA is attacking Russia. And Russia says, I will respond, and I will respond accordingly. I'm not going to be dealing with small fishes. I will respond with my missiles to the owner of those missiles. And all this happens when America is also giving missiles to Israel. You understand? But in the middle of that whole discussion where Zelensky was making a presentation to NATO, by the way, he's asking for more money and more missiles and more arms to can continue the war. Trump calls in Zelensky. Okay, Trump says it's Zelensky who calls him. You see, President Trump is not diplomatic. He even released the letter that Zelensky wrote to him to ask for a meeting. And one, obviously, President Zelensky, Volodymyr, is not happy that Trump went public about this. He wanted it a close meeting. So he thinks Trump is the bad choice for America. So it's, again, another foreign president is trying to influence elections in the U.S. Zelensky thinks it's better to have Harris because the Democrats seems to be supporting Ukraine more towards the aggression with Russia. So he says Trump, he first said something very bad about President Trump, and then he asked for a meeting with him to come and explain himself. And Trump is simply saying, but your plan is not going to work. You know, there's no victory plan. But I think Trump is realistic that there will be no victory against
Russia. Everyone is losing.
Everyone is losing.
Yeah.
And I think he's being realistic. That's why I'm saying He may not be a good talker in a public space, but he's got a practical mind. And I think that's what made President Trump a very good business person. You understand? He thinks practically. They're all losing into this whole thing. And I think Zelensky is also not, you know, diplomatic as a person. I don't know what is he benefiting when his country and his people are losing on this war. If I realize that my people and I'm a leader are losing on a war, I will do everything in my power to try and bring this war to an end. And he's not doing that. He's not doing that.
Are we happy with everything UN and the General Assembly?
Yeah, no.
Anything else on your mind?
I've covered the UN and the General Assembly. I think, like I said, the UN is a show off. It's a toothless dog. They sit there every year. They talk nonsense. It never works.
People find about polio and measles.
No, give them polio and measles and COVID. They will vaccinate the world a lot.
Papa, look vatly. Let's talk about Friends of Peace and China.
Oh, yes.
What is Friends of Peace and what are your views and thoughts about that?
Look, first of all, I must bring back the history. I think it's a very good attempt by China.
Yes, sir.
But this comes back from what used to be called IPSA, India, Brazil, South Africa. It was called the South-South Cooperation. India is in the south of Asia, South Africa in the south of Africa and Brazil. Then it became BRICS, which are also, you know, countries of the South that are not members of NATO. Now, what China is doing, China has called in a meeting of countries of the South and who are peace talking as well. You must not just say countries of the South. Countries like South Africa that are talking of peace in the world to say, let's stop all the wars, let's use diplomatic, you know, engagements in order to engage. So China is regrouping those countries who can engage regarding the Russia-Ukraine war to say, let us use diplomatic platforms. Something that, again, your friend joke, what do you call people who joke? What is his profession? Vladimir Volonsky. Vladimir.
He's a comedian.
Not Vladimir. He's a comedian by profession, by the way. He is again rebuking that, saying, no, China is not doing this in good faith because it's very close to Russia and South Africa is close to Russia. But when you enter into diplomatic negotiations, you bring everybody who's involved on the table. You can't say, I don't want friends of Russia to come and be on the negotiation table. You actually need friends of Russia more.
If vele it's about peace, then you need as much representation as possible.
But I'm even saying, as a peace negotiator, you need friends of your enemy more than enemies of your enemy. You know why? Because friends can sit and convince your enemy to say, it is not worth fighting. Mr. Putin, Zelensky is prepared to come to the table and talk. You can't say friends of Putin must not come to the table or must not initiate. You can't want to rely on friends of the North, which is NATO. What Zelensky is doing is he wants NATO to resolve the war. NATO can resolve the war and bring peace in between Ukraine and Russia because NATO is the perpetrator according to Russia.
Sure.
You understand? You can't say they are the ones who should bring peace. The only thing that will bring peace between Russia and Ukraine is NATO, when NATO is an active participant in the war. Now China is doing an attempt to say, let me bring those who are not involved. Let me bring those who have been talking peace. India, Brazil, South Africa, and other countries, Saudi Arabia, come, let's talk to Putin as friends and call a meeting between Putin and Zelensky. What's wrong with that?
But do you think Putin or anyone else would appreciate what seems like an intervention?
Look,
that's what it's going to read like.
Unless
we're all talking peace.
Yeah,
but if it's my my allies calling me to the side, it feels like an intervention.
They are intervening. It's okay. What's wrong with an intervention?
And President Putin doesn't strike me as one that would appreciate an intervention.
No. I don't know. I've got a different view.
Yeah.
His relation. Remember, to go to a full-blown war, you need your friends and your neighbors.
Yeah.
You understand? So I don't think President Putin will shut down what Jinping, the premier of China, you know, is going to propose. Let's sit and talk. Everybody wants peace. This war, as you said earlier on, everybody's losing in this war. I've read a statement issued by the ministry spokesperson, Minister of Foreign Affairs of Russia. They are saying they are prepared to engage on any engagement or diplomatic or whatever, but that is not going to stop them from fighting while negotiations are happening, because NATO is not stopping what they are doing. That's the first part. The second part, they are saying they will engage in any diplomatic engagement to can stop what they call a military operation. Remember, they don't call it a war. Russia says this is a military operation to stop NATO from advancing to their shoreline or their borders.
Yes.
You understand? If anything that says NATO, you'll stop what started this war, what broke the 2014 peace accord. Remember, this comes from the 2014 peace accord. You understand? So Russia is saying, if anybody says we should talk in stopping that, we will listen, we will get engaged. I don't think smart people who read The Art of War, and I think President Putin is one of those products of the Art of War. People who read the book, who live by The Art of War by the former general, you know, the Chinese General Sun Tzu, they will know that The Art of War actually does not talk about the war. It talks about peace.
Yes.
The Art of War is talking about to avoid war by all means necessary. Only go in when you don't have a choice anymore. So I see President Putin as a person who lives by the art of war, who says, if there's an opportunity, I'm not losing anything. I've already lost during the war. But if there's an opportunity to go into a peace, negotiated a peace settlement, and everybody walks happy from the table, I will enter into those negotiations. That's what the art of war prescribes to some of us. But I think this is a good attempt by China. And I think South Africa should be in the middle of that. But you know why China is also pushing for this?
Sure.
They are losing economically. Remember, this thing has an impact on economic trade as well. They are losing. They are friends with Russia, friends with... China is trading with everybody in the world, including the U.S. You understand? To this day, I sometimes think politicians, even those that I love, like President Putin, are bullshitting us. America, to this day, is still buying commodities from Russia.
Yes.
They're still buying gas from even under economic embargo and sanctions. So what nonsense is this that these political heads, leaders of the world, are saying Russia is under sanctions and they're still buying their commodities because for their own survival? You see the selfish state position of politicians. Yeah, for their survival, America buys what they need. From China, other countries that are pro Russia are buying commodities like wheat from Ukraine. The other day I talked about how Turkey, which I don't trust Turkey in this war. They seem to be playing double dipping, double standards. Turkey is talking about Russia, this Israel, this must end. We need peace. Hey, Turkey, the pipeline that supplies Israel with gas and fuel, it crosses Turkey.
Yes.
If you want Israel not to have fuel, you must cut that pipeline. Then I will believe that Turkey is doing and telling the truth. But again, they are playing the world. You know, everybody wants to be seen as a peacemaker. Everybody wants to be seen as I'm the one who brought this peace.
Absolutely.
And therefore, I'm the most important person. They don't care about reality on the ground. And some of us are awake enough to realize that they're playing the world with games. The only president that I can trust in this, who does things the way he talks, is Traore in the Sahel, in Burkina Faso.
Yes.
You know, he lives by what he's saying. He doesn't play marbles. He's showing true leadership and for the people, the rest.
And doesn't hesitate.
He doesn't hesitate.
He makes a call and he goes.
The rest talk left, walk right. Some they don't walk. They are just stuck in the middle. We don't know if they're still existing as countries. You know, they just went silent. I mean, we are busy as Africans worried about the war in Russia and Ukraine. Yes, it impacts us as member of the global community. We are worried about the war of the Palestinian children by Israel. Right now, this past week in Sudan. In Sudan, remember the paramilitary took over some sections of Khartoum, the capital,
a
few months back. The military went into fully-fledged war in Khartoum, in Sudan, to reclaim the capital city back. Now, nobody's talking about it. You know why? Because they're getting nothing out of Khartoum at the moment. There's nothing to be interested. Understand? They are already oiling their oil very well enough on the south part of Sudan. and they are comfortable until this war in Sudan impacts on the oil wells owned by Shell and Best Petroleum of Britain and it starts impacting foreign nationals. Then the world will talk about it. For as long as it does not impact on their economic and exploitation interest,
it's none of my business.
It's none of their business.
Absolutely. In conclusion,
yes, brother.
Let's talk about Russia welcoming any efforts to stop what they still call this military operation. Do you think there's hope in terms of this thing stopping?
Fresh, I, you know, this is personal. I think there's hope. I think the fact that Russia is welcoming the efforts,
yes,
it will stop. I think it's gradually coming. The countries of the world are tired. NATO countries themselves, they can't afford to fund this war anymore.
It's a bucket to the hole.
Exactly. Mm. But that's also another thing that has impacted a lot of these countries is Russia now pushing the BRICS decision of trading with own currencies like the ruble. You know, President Putin announced during the course of this week, when they were busy in the UN, remember he's banned, he can't go there.
Yeah.
Even if they are members, even if they're a permanent member of the Security Council.
You know, at least he can send a representative.
Yeah, but he was talking about how Russia has clocked over 40% on international trade and payments with the ruble, the currency. They've kept the dollar out, and he says it's increasing. And that's 40% with their own currency. We haven't counted the currency of the countries that they've traded with. It is 20%. So almost 60%, up to 60% of the trade with Russia that has happened in the last year under sanctions has not happened in a dollar.
Yes, sir.
And for them, I think it's important for the war to stop in order to increase this economic trade. Russia will benefit more if the war stops and then they start trading. Especially that the platform has been set. It has been set by BRICS. They are hosting BRICS in the next 4 weeks. You know, everybody will be ascending there. And I've seen members of NATO like France, they've raised their hands to say, please invite me. If I was President Putin, I wouldn't invite any NATO member state into this summit of BRICS in Russia. I would not take those chances to do that. Even I think also Russia should be very careful. If I was a Russian, I would advise the president to go and fight hard enough in the BRICS summit not to accept member states of the West easily. Because there's a lineup of countries from the West. Some of them are NATO member states who have applied. Some are friends of the West that we know that have lined up to join BRICS. If I was a Russian, even a Chinese, South Africa, you can't count it, shame. We can't. We go where the wind blows. But if I was a Russian, I would say to President Vladimir Putin, stop now. Go and fight. Go and talk, not to admit these people first. Let's first admit our friends, then our neutral countries. They can still trade with the West bilaterally. But to put them in the BRICS bloc, BRICS must not get excited about expansion.
Yes,
it may be swallowed by the same people of the G7 and the G20 that they are trying to run away from, that they are trying to counter. You can't just say, this company is dominating my company, therefore I'm going to form new partnership with another company. Then you invite the same people from the company that you are running away from. I don't think it's a good move.
Yes, sir.
But I think Russia is in a good position now to can start talking, you know, peace. And I know that Russia is not going to compromise. I've listened to the Russian ambassador in South Africa saying, we are not going to compromise on what led us to a military operation. That they will not compromise. But they can start engaging.
Yes.
And countries of the West are so compromised at the moment. Finland, Germany, France, and you know, all those are the UK itself is having a problem with its citizens that they are using, you know, their ailing economy to can fund the NATO war. And this is the opportunity to go and engage diplomatically when the enemy is compromised. Oh, the opposition is compromised. That's the art of war I spoke about earlier.
Absolutely.
Know when to engage the enemy militarily and know when to engage the enemy on a negotiation table. And I think this is the moment for the negotiation table. Both aggressors, NATO and Russia, have shown their muscle enough now for almost 3 years.
Yes.
That they can challenge each other. Whoa, guys, it's enough. Spare us your nukes. Reserve them for future. For now, we can go to the diplomatic table. That's my view on this issue.
Amen.
Thank you, brother man.
So we've been having on and off connection issues.
Okay.
But this episode will definitely be available to view for those that might
have online.
Issues.
Okay. Yeah.
For those that might have had issues. In closing, brother, what are you looking forward to this week?
Well, brother man, not much happening. You know, things are going to be subtle. The UN and the parliament is going to start working.
Yes, sir.
To this week. And those who went abroad will be coming back. The president and his delegation, if they are not yet back at.
Yes,
you were saying 14 days to Tswan, or up to 14 days. I don't think it will happen within 14 days. I think they are going to wait for the last minute. So let's wait and see, brother man. And I'm just happy with the viewers that we pulled another live episode, challenging one.
And, you know, as much as we're having the challenges that we're having, we will iron them out and we will, yeah, we'll get the rhythm that we need and that we want.
Exactly.
But we insist on a live show because we can deal with things that happened last night, this morning, and things that are happening as we do the episode.
As we do the episode. It's absolutely interesting. You know, I was listening to the news that I came here, and this news that we can discuss with the followers and the viewers.
Yes, sir.
And I hope all the glitches, you know, our technical team will be able to can handle all the glitches.
Yes, sir.
And I'm sure that Trevor and the team will be able to can have this episode as normal, be loaded in that people can watch after, even those who went to shops and funerals.
Yes,
one day we must get cameras on the opposite side and show people Trevor sitting there.
Pulling his hair out. Busan, how do we get a hold of you?
Thanks, Fresh. It's on WhatsApp 082-485-9100. And
is that strictly for business or?
It's for business only.
Or proposals?
I don't know. Business proposals, yes, that I will take. And then on social media, it's at BotsangM. And on email, it's BotsangM@gmail.com. Oh, by the way, you're asking what is also happening. It's month end. Eh?
Yes, sir.
I had opened a competition at the beginning of, it's at the middle of last month for my two upcoming books that I had targeted kids between the age of 12 and 16 to can do the graphic design of the books. I've received about 16, I'm so disappointed, I expected more, 16 applications or contestants or proposals.
Okay.
And then I'm going to review them over this weekend. And then I will announce to those that which logo I think I will go with. Not logo, the graphic.
Or design.
The design I'll go with, yes.
Great stuff.
There's one that I saw, it really catch my eye, but I said, let me not get excited. Let me wait for others. The closing date is on the 31st. So I'm going to start looking at it. So next weekend I'll probably announce on this platform who are the lucky ones.
Great stuff.
Yeah.
Wow, what a week. Hashtag Polytrix. Coming to you live from the Don Boshaba Mobile Studio. If you'd like to hire the studio, email bookings@djfresh.com. bookings@djfresh.com. And for other business, email waw@africapodcastnetwork.com. Shout out to Pezulu Works, Trevor and his team for all of the videography. Shout out to Butzang, our political and analyst. And you for tuning in, for interacting, for subscribing, for liking, and for sharing far and wide. And last shout out to Gilles Omudisa King, our executive producer. I think until next week, have a wild week in spite of yourselves.